Now this morning we're going to be continuing on in Genesis. This is an overview of the Bible and we're really just getting started with it. But I need to kind of review with you very quickly from what we covered last week. It took about 1,500 years from the time that Adam and Eve were created and the fall into sin for their descendants to become so bad that Genesis 6:5 says, every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. They were utterly evil. And it was because of that great wickedness that in Genesis 6:7, God said that he was going to, quote, blot out man, whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. God was going to send a flood and destroy them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And God told Noah what he was about to do and told him to build an ark in preparation for the flood that was going to come so that he and a representative pair of all the land animals that breathe there would survive the flood and be able to replenish the earth afterward. Noah was faithful in what God charged him to do. Everything that God commanded, Noah did. We're told that twice, Genesis 6:22 and 7:5. The comment in Genesis 6:3 indicates it may have been about 120 years he was working on the ark, and that entire time of construction, Hebrews 11:7 tells us, was a warning of the coming condemnation upon the world. I mean, we would do the same thing. If someone started building this huge boat in their backyard, we're going to say, what is that? We'll start asking questions. 2 Peter 2:5 says he was a preacher of righteousness. Noah would tell them a warning. This is what's going to happen. This is going to be the only means of safety. Now, we have no idea what kind of ridicule, persecution Noah would have received during that time. Those who are righteous now receive it. But imagine having something like this, working out for so long, your neighbor's all wicked. What kind of ridicule and persecution they put you through as you're building this thing. But the day came, and when the flood was going to begin, God told Noah to get in the ark, take all the animals with him, and then the Lord shut the door. And when he shut the door, Noah, his family, the animals were sealed safely inside. But all those outside who refused to come in, the message was given to them, they refused to come in, were sealed to their doom outside the ark of safety. Well, the description of that flood is one of worldwide catastrophe. The source of water for it were the fountains of the deep, the floodgates of the sky. It rained for 40 days straight. It was a huge flood. The description is, again, worldwide in its how it's explained. In fact, it says that all the mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. In fact, the water reached to a height of 15 cubits over the highest peaks, about 22 feet. It prevailed for 150 days at that level, and since water doesn't stack, it's not a local flood, it's not a regional flood. It's a universal flood. In addition, chapter 7, verses 21 through 23 makes three universal statements that all air-breathing land animals died. Only those in the ark survived. And then to back up those three statements in verse 23, it says that only Noah was left together with those that were with him in the ark. That's it. The ark was vital. If you were not in it, you perished. Well, God finally brought the flood to an end. But it would be 3 months before the mountaintops would be seen. 224 days after it stopped, it finally receded enough the mountaintops were seen. It'd be another 4 months before they could finally leave the ark. Noah and his families were in the ark for a total of 1 year and 17 days, and then they were able to depart. The world that had been perished. 2 Peter 3:6 tells us that as well. The world that was no longer. It was completely redone. Wiped out. Most of us have seen the effects of some local flood. Imagine that on a worldwide scale, what it would have looked like. Bits and pieces and stuff all around. But everything's torn up. That's the world they came into. Starting in Genesis 9, we find that God gives Noah not only some new instructions for living in this new world, but also some new promises. We'll look at those in a moment. Now, you'd think after going through this kind of traumatic experience that Noah's descendants would be extremely careful in obeying everything God said because they wouldn't want to come under his judgment again. Yet, when we get to chapter 11, we're going to find that that was not the case. Chapter 10 gives a description of the genealogy coming out of Moses and his descendants and where they all scattered because of their sin. We're going to get to that today as well. And yet, chapter 11 ends with hope. Man continues in rebellion against God, and yet God always leaves a remnant. There is always hope. And we'll find that at the end of chapter 11. Well, chapter 8 ends with Noah offering burnt offerings, sacrifices to God out of gratitude that he has survived. He and the animals, they have survived. They're replenishing the earth. He is grateful. He sacrifices to God in worship. But again, this world is radically different than what he had been in prior to the flood. And the first thing we find is there's a new food source. Look at verse 1, chapter 9. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky. With everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant." So there's a repetition of the command back in Genesis 1:28 to have children, to multiply and to fill the earth. But there is a change now in the relationship that man had with the animals. Man's still going to rule over the animals, but the animals are now going to be afraid of man. Apparently, prior to that, they'd be more like our tame animals. There would be no problem. They wouldn't run away. There was nothing to fear in man. But now there would be, because specifically, God has given the animals to man as another source of food. And certainly that would make animals afraid. I know that on a hunting season, if you don't get your deer the first day, unless you're Randy Ryan, you're probably not going to get one. Is that right, Randy? Very possible. The deer scatter. They know when someone's in there and they run. Okay? It takes a while for them to get as tame as the ones that are in my garden weekly. They're not. But we're trying to put some fear back in it and we sick the dog after it. And it runs away and my garden's safe for an hour. But it had changed. It had changed. Now, this is a very important point in dealing with vegetarianism. Because we have an idea that has been promoted at our time that somehow vegetarianism is somehow morally superior or more healthy. You need to understand some things that have happened. Now, first of all, notice in the text itself, it doesn't say that man must eat the animals. It says they are given to him as another source of food, just like the plants. So it is up to you to decide what you want to eat or not. The text says that all of them have been given to you, but I can think of quite a few animals that I would rather not exercise this provision in sampling. You can probably think of some, too, that you would just as soon let it go. Okay? It doesn't say you have to eat it, but it says it is another source of food for them. But those who advocate vegetarianism as morally superior or more healthy have a problem when they run into this text. Because it specifically says it is given to man as a source of food. So it cannot be morally superior. This is specifically what God has it here. In addition, we have to deal with the idea of would it be healthier? You need to understand that the flood changed everything. Not only has the flood changed the soil structure, when you have water coming through like that, it changes everything that's there. But also you have something else that's new that destroys soils. Rain. Rain first fell at the beginning of the flood. Rain leaches the minerals out of the soil and moves them down deeper. The plants then, trying to get the nutrients out of the soil, have less to get. That's one reason why tropical areas, the food quality is so poor. There's not enough minerals there for the plant to really be healthy. So this change of environment means that the plants themselves are not going to be as healthy as they were prior to the flood, and they're not going to bring as much nutrition in as they would have prior to the flood. We know this from millennia of farming practices that you must fertilize in order to keep crop production even at the same level. And that's not even saying that the plant itself is going to have as much nutritional value for you as it would have had prior to the flood. Animals eat a lot of plants, concentrate the nutrition that is there, and that's why especially the proteins, animal products are important for us. It concentrates the proteins enough that we can take them in and assimilate them into our own bodies. Otherwise, the amount of stuff you have to eat to get that kind of nutrition, well, we'd all be pretty big, okay? Because you have to have big bellies just to absorb it all, like cows and other things, just to try and get the nutrition out. The flood changed everything, okay? We need to understand that. In addition, and again, I want to stress, whether you want to eat animal products or not, it's simply a food source that's available to you. If you don't want to partake of it, that's up to you. However, as soon as someone starts advocating and saying that we must or you must abstain from animal products, they've got a problem with 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. And this is important enough. I'd like you to turn there. Starting in verse 1, 1 Timothy chapter 4, it says this: "But the Spirit explicitly says that in the latter times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons, by means of the hypocrisy of liars seared in their own conscience as with a branding iron, men who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods which God has created to be gravely shared in by those who believe and know the truth. For everything by God, created by God, is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with gratitude. It is sanctified by means of the Word of God and prayer." To advocate vegetarianism, saying that we must abstain, is a doctrine from demons. Yes, it is serious. But there's a lot of people who fall into that and then want to say that somehow they're superior. We go back to the Word of God and see what it says. Okay? Now, there was one source of protein, though, from animals man was commanded not to eat, and that was the blood. "Only you shall not eat the flesh with its life," that is, its blood. Now, the reason for that will be fully explained in the Mosaic Law, Leviticus chapter 16. But God does not have to explain to us all of His reasons for His commands for us to obey them. It is enough that He is God, we are not God, therefore we should obey Him. That's enough. And yet God in His graciousness generally does explain the reasons for His various commands. And we will get to that in Leviticus 16. Now, God also established something else in the post-flood world, and that was a punishment for those who murder a human. Remember back with Cain and Abel? They were not. Cain was not murdered, neither was Lamech. He wasn't executed. Post-flood, there is capital punishment established. Verse 5, "Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it. And from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man." Now, societies continue to debate capital punishment, but the Bible is quite clear on the subject. Now, there are certainly secondary reasons, such as justice and deterrent for capital punishment, but the primary reason is the simple. Man is made in God's image. And so when someone kills somebody else, murders them, it's not just an act against that person. It is an action against God Himself. It is an attack upon His glory. And that's serious. Now, later on in the Mosaic Law, there's going to be more definition given to this. The difference between killing and murder, the difference between, such as in war or execution, and the different types of murder, whether it's accidental or premeditated, and when capital punishment comes into play. But it's instituted back here. Man is made in the image of God. That is why his life is valuable, because we reflect God Himself. So those who continue to object to capital punishment for murderers, they find themselves in opposition to one of God's clear commands. And that's not a good place to be. Okay? They're opposing God. Now, verse 7, God again repeats His command to them to be fruitful, multiply, populate the earth abundantly, multiply in it. Now, that command is very important in understanding what happens in chapter 11. Now, in chapter 8, or chapter 9, verses 8 through 19, we have an expansion of the promise given to Moses when he immediately got off the ark. And this is what we call the Noahic Covenant. Basically, it is that God is not going to destroy man or the animals through a flood again. It will not happen. And the sign for it is going to be the rainbow. Now, this also says that there's a physical structural change of the earth's atmosphere after the flood. Now, we know the floodgates of heaven were open. The windows of heaven were open. It rained for 40 days. And we can only speculate as to the nature of all the changes that were made, but something did change. And one of them is that direct sunlight passing through rain droplets, the light refracts into the spectrum. We get a rainbow out of that. Prior to the flood, there was no rain. There was no rainbows to be seen in the clouds. After the flood, you have this phenomenon occurring, and so rainbows are a constant reminder of God's promise. He is not going to flood the world again. The water that was there has already come down. Rain falling is a constant reminder God has made a promise to us. But it is also this. Every time you've seen a rainbow is a reminder that the world is not the same as it was when it was created. God has judged the world before. He's promised not to judge it in the same way again. He will judge it in a different way. Now, I find it interesting that both New Agers and homosexuals have tried to adopt the rainbow as a sign for themselves. Next time you see one of those things, have some fun, okay? Go up to them, comment, oh, it's a pretty rainbow. And they say, do you understand what the rainbow is really all about? See if they know. I doubt very much they know what the rainbow really is about. Explain to them and say that God still offers hope of safety in Jesus Christ. Do you know Him? You need to, okay? Use the opportunities that are around us. And the rainbow is one of them. They're seen all over the place, but most people don't know what they really mean. In verses 18 and 19, it's pointed out and stressed that it was from Noah's three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, that all the people who are now on earth arose. We are their descendants. The full genetic potential that we see expressed in all the people around us today were in this family. We're one blood, as Acts 17:26 states. Verse 18 also points out that Ham was the father of Canaan, who's an individual that figures in very important in the next section. Look at chapter 9, verse 20. Then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine, became drunk, and uncovered himself inside his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. Now, there were other physical changes that had occurred in the environment following the flood. One of them would have been a reduction in air pressure. There's a lot of speculation and work that's been done on trying to figure out what kind of water canopy surrounded the heavens prior to the flood. Ice canopy has been proposed, water vapor canopy, cloud canopy. Several ideas have been proposed. But regardless of which one it was, and we don't know which one, there's still a lot of work being done on it, if you have water surrounding the earth, you increase the pressure, the atmospheric pressure on the earth. Okay, we all know if you go swimming, you dive down, you feel your ears, the pressure. That's what you have. If you have something above you, it creates pressure. We know that when you go up a mountain, as you're going up, you hear your ears will pop. Okay, it's a reduction in pressure. If you're in a plane and you come down too fast, you feel a lot of pain because your ears didn't pop and there's an unequal pressure. There's a physical change. There was water above and around the earth. It's no longer there. Pressure has changed. It's reduced. Now, without that kind of pressure, you're making wine, you're making grape juice, and there's yeast around, it will start to ferment. The higher the pressure, the less it can ferment because the gas itself can only go so far, and then that pressure itself keeps the the reactions going on by the yeast from even happening. So if you put grape juice in a bottle and keep it pressurized, it doesn't ferment. You reduce the pressure, like pop the top off a soda bottle, the pressure is released, and now these gases can come out. If you let more gases come out, the process can go farther. You produce more alcohol in the fermentation process. In other words, Noah was probably surprised at the effect of the wine upon himself. He probably had made wine before and didn't have this kind of reaction to it. But the atmosphere has changed. It's different than it was before. It's a different world than what it had been prior to the flood. Now his grape juice had fermented to such a point, he's drunk on it. Now Noah goes into his tent. He takes off all his clothes. Now this may have been just because of the extra heat generated as the alcohol dilates the veins. He's hot. He takes off his clothes. He's in his tent. It may be because he's just drunk. He doesn't even really realize what he's doing. He's in his tent. He doesn't have his clothes on. For some reason, Ham goes in and he sees his father's nakedness, comes out and tells his brothers. Shem and Japheth then go in. They actually get a sheet and they walk in backwards with a sheet and cover their father. Now that was out of respect for their father. They did not want to see him in such a state. Ham didn't do that. That tells us from the beginning, Ham's character is not as good as Shem and Japheth. However, verse 24 and the curse that follows suggests Ham's youngest son, Canaan, did something. Nothing in this text says Ham did anything other than he went in and he saw his dad. But nothing else is said. It says, when Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. Now, Ham is always listed in the middle. He is not the youngest son. He's the middle son. The phrase youngest son can as easily refer to whatever boy is present that's the youngest one, and that would have been Canaan. Canaan is the youngest grandson. In Hebrew, the son, grandson, it can be used pretty interchangeably. The youngest one. That would have been Canaan. And when we look at the curse, he's further implicated. Verses 25, 26, and 27 have a curse on Canaan. He is going to be a servant. The God of Shem is blessed. Shem is blessed, and Japheth is enlarged. It says, so he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, he shall be to his brothers. He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. No, we're not told what Canaan did. We're simply told enough that whatever he did was bad enough that he ends up with a curse. And it's a serious curse. In fact, three times it's repeated. Canaan is going to be a servant to his brothers. Now the fulfillment of that is going to be recorded in the conquering of what we now call Palestine. That whole area is conquered not only by Israel but by other nations as well, and those people become the slaves of the conquering nations. But again, Shem is blessed and Japheth is blessed. Now Noah lives for another 350 years after the flood. Lives for a total of 950 years. He is the last person to live that long. All of his descendants will live much shorter lives. In fact, Shem only lives two-thirds as long as Noah, not even quite two-thirds. Now, chapter 10 records this genealogy of Noah and his sons, especially those particular lines that become important in Israel's history. Some of them doesn't say a whole lot because they don't really figure into Israel's history. Other lines, great detail is given because they do figure into Israel's history in the future. And remember, the book of Genesis is compiled by Moses, written by him, to the generation that came out of the Exodus to let them know their history before they go into the land and conquer it. Now, chapter 11 recounts the event that finally scattered the people. So we're going to jump to chapter 11 and then come back to chapter 10. Because we want to find out why these people are scattered. Chapter 10 gives a list of these people, tells where they were. Chapter 11 tells you why they got scattered. Verse 11, man's continued rebellion. Verse 1, chapter 11, verse 1. Now, it the whole earth, used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used bricks for stone and they used tar for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." Now, it's very important to note here, this effort is in direct defiance to God's command to multiply and fill the earth. They say, "We do not want to be scattered abroad," and so they are refraining from doing so, and decide that they're going to instead build this tower. Now, you got to remember, the Ark lands in the mountains of Ararat. They would have come down off the mountain to lower elevations. Noah, we told, planted a vineyard, so he settled somewhere, resumed his agricultural activity. Apparently, his immediate sons also settled somewhere in that area. But as the population grew, and it would have grown fairly rapidly, especially if you live a long period of time as they did then, you would have lots of sons and daughters, and population grows. It shifted eastward. They get to this plain, but instead of continuing to shift around and scatter, they decide, "We're going to camp here. We refuse to fill the earth. We're going to stay together. We're going to build a city. And it's going to be of such a nature, the tower of it will reach to heaven." The word is word for Babel itself actually means to the gate of heaven. What they built in their pride as they turned against God is what we call a ziggurat. It's associated with astrology and worship of the sun, moon, and stars. It's a pyramid-type structure. The top of it would represent heaven. Ancient ones where they have gone in and studied these things are often depicted as being heaven. They'd be painted with astrological signs and things like that. So it's like, this is going to be our heaven. It's false worship. That's what's going on. They're going to do things their own way. Now, ruins of a particular ziggurat, well, there's ziggurats, ruins of them all through what is Persia, Syria, now modern Iraq and Iran. But there's a particular one called Burz Nimrod. It's 8 to 10 miles southwest of the remains of ancient Babylon. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar rebuilt it. He redid it when he became king, so it existed long before him. But again, they were part of false worship. Now, the leader of this group, we were told about in chapter 10, verses 8 through 12, is a fellow named Nimrod. Nimrod is Ham's grandson through Cush. And it says he was a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, apparently, his hunting abilities add to his reputation. He became a leader. You got to remember, after they're out of the ark, the animals also now are different than man was. Some of them are dangerous, and it probably was a very good thing to have a good hunter, someone to protect the population. This just added to his ability to lead. He is the one, then, that established a kingdom, the first city of which was Babel. He later built other cities in the plains of Shinar, modern Mesopotamia, Iraq, and then later built Nineveh and some other cities in the far north area of that Fertile Crescent. Now, Nimrod's name itself means rebellion. And the Jerusalem Targum says this of Nimrod, quote, He was powerful in hunting and in wickedness before the Lord, for he as a hunter of the sons of men. And he said to them, "Depart from the judgment of the Lord and adhere to the judgment of Nimrod." He was a rebellious man. He was a wicked man. Well, the Lord's response is there in verses 5 through 9. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible to them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad. Now this rebellion by Nimrod and his followers occurs fairly quickly. It is only 100 to 300 years after the flood. and already you have this kind of rebellion. If the phrase in Genesis 10:25 about the earth being divided in the days of Peleg is referring to this, that's only the third generation down. This is soon. Noah and his sons would have still been alive. And yet their children have rejected what the parents had learned. But that's nothing new, is it? That still happens today, doesn't it? Parents learn some things the very hard way, and there's nothing more important to them than their children learn the lessons from them the easy way. Learn it from your parents' experience, but children so often still is, I'm going to do it my way, I'm not paying attention to you, it doesn't matter. Who cares about history? Somehow I'm better than those people. It's not true, and they have to learn the lesson all over again. They should have learned from Noah and his three sons. Instead, they've turned in rebellion against God. They have forgotten what already had happened. Well, God intervened directly into the plans of man to prevent him from building this tower, and he forced them to scatter abroad. He forced them to obey his command. Now, the ability to communicate allows people to share ideas and then come up with things they could not have otherwise. That's one reason why it's important for a nation to have one language, because then we can all communicate together and we build on each other's ideas. Technology goes forward that way. Now, we're very familiar with that because we've seen so much technological advance in our own time. Why? A big reason is because of our ability to communicate with each other has advanced so fast. You know, it's not just even printed stuff. It's not just that we all speak the same language, or at least similar language. Some of you just can't seem to pronounce some words correctly. That's okay. You can't understand my relatives either. But we speak a language that's similar. But we have phones and all sorts of ways to communicate very rapidly with each other. Clarify what we're saying so we build up on each other's ideas. And technology advances upon that. If you remove that ability, that all collapses. It becomes very difficult to know what the other person's talking about. Throw in man's pride, and they don't want to learn the other person's language. Right? And Americans are probably some of the worst on this. There's an old joke about, who are the people who only know one language? It's Americans. Everybody else learns two or three. But it's it. If you have people who have different languages and you get together, which language are you going to talk? Which language, who's going to give what to learn the new language or learn the other person's language to communicate? We don't. We're all ethnic-centric. We think our way is best. You learn what I'm saying. Well, that would have happened at the Tower of Babel. Everybody's language is now different. In addition to not just being different, understand that this is something that is a miracle of mind as well as speech. Now, God does this in part to keep man from doing things that he shouldn't be doing. It keeps him from going into more harm. But this particular thing was a miracle not only of speech, but of the mind. Language reflects a manner of thinking as well. Different languages are put together very differently than English. And there's a mindset that goes with it. There's a way of thinking that goes with it. Now you have all these people, they're all speaking different languages, and each of them is going to think that they are the ones who have the correct language. You changed, you've got to figure out what I'm doing. And getting frustrated, well, they all scatter. They scatter along family lines throughout the earth. God was very effective in what he did. Now, by confusing these languages, then God not only disrupted their ability to communicate and therefore their ability to work together, it forces them to separate. So now he does what they told him to do to begin with. Multiply, fill the earth. But it's also where we get our different ethnic groups and our languages. Now, the origin of many languages that exist today, again, is this miracle of mind and speech, but it is something that spread out from one place and happened all at once. We have those who are modern linguists, and they speak about languages evolving. Languages do not evolve. To evolve means that it's going to improve. It's going to be better than it was before. Languages do not do this. And linguists should be honest enough to tell you that. They do the opposite. Languages tend to dumb down. Think about how often your teacher got onto you in English class about your poor grammar, right? Or any language class you take, your teacher will get onto you about your grammar. Right, Mrs. Condor? She teaches Spanish. Your grammar is bad. We don't know what you're saying. Okay? You've got to get the grammar correctly. Languages tend to dumb down. Words are used and they lose their meaning because they're used for things that they weren't intended for to begin with, and they gain a new meaning. Therefore, it loses precision in meaning. And we're not sure what you're talking about anymore. I have a cousin whose middle name is Gay. When she was named that, Gay meant happy. The Gay 90s of the 1890s meant it was a very happy time. Now we say it and most of you are thinking of something else. Can you use that word anymore? It loses precision. Another example. Some of you like the King James Bible, the older one, not the New King James, and it's full of these and thous. Those are extremely helpful to us in knowing the part of speech you're referring to. Second person, plural, or singular. We just replace it with you. But if I say you, who am I talking about? Am I talking about you, Larissa? Or everybody? We don't know anymore. Languages degrade. They don't get better. Again, it points out that even this, as languages started somewhere, very, very precise, and they have been degrading since then to what we have now. It points back to Babel. Now, where did these people scatter? Now, that goes back to chapter 10. And we put this together as simply some charts for you so you can see it very quickly. Japheth had seven sons. Gomer, the first one, his descendants settled in Galatia, France, Spain, Wales, and then also in Armenia. So most of Western Europe, and then one group kind of to the northeast Armenia. His children also populated parts of what is now modern-day Turkey. Mysia and Phrygia are in modern-day Turkey. Raphaean Mountains are there, so is Galatia. Magog, that was the Scythians. They went north into Romania and what is now Ukraine. Madai, the Medes, the Persians, India. Northeast and then east and then south and kept spreading. His other sons, Javan, they were the Greeks, so Greece as well as Tarshish, which is part of what's on modern Turkey as well. Kittim is Cyprus, Dodinum. Tubal went north into Russia and Georgia. Meshach went all the way up to Moscow. Tyrus was Thrace, Macedonia, Serbia, the area just north of Greece. If we mapped it out, you would come something like this. This whole area here, the lighter color, this is all the general areas where descendants of Japheth went. Okay? Now, there will be pockets of others that would go different places, but that's the general area they went. Then there's the descendants of Ham. Now, Ham has four sons, Cush, Mizraim, and Put, and Canaan. Cush, his descendants, Ethiopia, Africa, as well as some of them stayed in the Mesopotamian Valley. Nimrod was from Cush. So that area of now Iraq and Iran was in that area, and some in a few places in the Arabian Peninsula. Mizraim went to Egypt, as well as some of the areas surrounding that, the north coast of Africa. Put went to Libya and the farther reaches of North Africa. And then Canaan, remember, he is the one that is cursed. He is the one that settles Palestine. Okay? So if I'm looking at Cush, that's these... Well, it doesn't come out too well on that, but it's this area here that's it's supposed to be yellow. This is supposed to be green, but it's this area. Africa, Palestine, and some areas here in Iraq. Now, it's important to note one other thing here. Who is the son that is cursed? It is Canaan. Canaan is the one that settles modern Palestine. The Jebusites, Zemarites, Girgashites, Sidonians, Amorites, Sinites, Arvidites, and then there's a few more that go up farther up the coast. They are the ones that are cursed. Okay? Cush is another son of Ham. And Cush itself, the word means black. His descendants went where? Down into Africa. Those people who had extremely dark skin, and we say they're black, are descendants from Cush. Cush went to Africa. There has been in times past those who want to go to this passage in Genesis and say black people should be slaves because they were cursed. They are absolutely, totally wrong. Cush was not cursed. Canaan was cursed. It gets really irritating when people don't bother to read their Bible and then claim the Bible is backing up their sin. This is the truth. Cush was not cursed. Canaan was cursed. Cush went to Africa. Canaan settled Palestine. And as we will see when we continue on in our series, all those people end up being taken over by other nations. They are made into slaves. They do not exist now. They've been incorporated other places. There are no Canaanites. Period. They do not exist. Okay? They were taken over by other people and assimilated away. Okay? Just want to make sure I got that clear to everybody because it seems to be a surprise to people. Every once in a while, I still hear that kind of stuff go out. It's not true. Canaan was the cursed one. Okay, the descendants of Shem, I know you can't read all those names from where you are, but he has four sons, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. Elam, Persia, Aram, Asher, Assyria. Shem, the dark here, is the line of Messiah. This is the line of promise. So that's why it's there. And then Lud went to Lydia, which is in North Africa. Amram went into Syria. So they also spread out. If we map them out, see here, Lud's over here. Eber, Aram, the northern areas, Elam, actually Ophir coming all the way around to the corner of India, but a lot of them went down the Arabian Peninsula and in what's now Iran, Iraq. Okay, this includes Eber, from where we get Hebrew from, which becomes the line that becomes important to us next. If we generalize the table of nations, this is what we find. Ham, Canaan up in the Palestine area, rest down in Africa, a few exceptions. Japheth, Europe, and then off into Asia. And then Shem was the area in the Arabian Peninsula and then down along a corner of India. That's just a generalization. Now, then we get to this genealogy and we can put it all together. God has judged man. The world is different. And that is seen in this genealogy. Now, the genealogy at the end of chapter 11 is tracing the line of Shem all the way down to Abram. We'll talk about Abram next week because he's the one that the line of promise goes through. So this is simply that line. But notice here what has happened. The length of life, this is the year they were born, year to date after the creation. This is the year they would have died. This is how long they lived. Notice how the number of years continues to diminish rapidly. It goes down exponentially. The world is different. The curse of sin is upon man, seen more and more upon them. And yet God always has hope. The hope will be in Abraham. I thought it would be interesting to chart these out for you as well. Shem, Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Terah, and Abraham. But notice as well, if you chart them out in there, here's the end of Noah's life. You go straight down. A lot of these people were born and Noah was still alive. Shem is still alive during Abraham's lifetime. It makes you wonder sometime, did any of these people go back and talk to great-great-great-great-grandpa? Did they learn something from them? Is that part of the reason they stayed on track? Who else did Abraham talk to that he had know the truth about what had happened? It isn't that far distant in the past for them. These people are still alive. It's there, but you have to go find out the truth. The same thing is still true today. The truth is there, but you have to go find it out. You can't go on your own wisdom. It was a different world following the flood. There were not only environmental changes, there were changes in the relationship between man and animals. There were changes in the laws concerning murder. There was a new punishment. Man was supposed to multiply and fill the earth. He became proud and arrogant, decided he'd disobey God, and yet God intervened and forced the issue. God also preserved a line. All the way back in Genesis 3, remember, there was a hope given. There was the seed, the woman's seed, that would crush the serpent's head. And that's what we're tracing. The line is continuing on. It's continuing through Shem and will be traced down to Abram, which we'll deal with next week. Father, thank you again for your word, the truth of it. And Father, there is so much in these early chapters, it's hard not to get bogged down with it and just keep going on and on with them, because there's so much there, and yet we want to give an overview. We want people to understand the overall message that you've given us. Father, the main one is simply use your grace and mercy to sinful people. You could have, and maybe some way should have, destroyed all people, but you didn't. You had a different plan. You had a plan of redemption. Thank you that it's traced through Noah. There were those who survived the flood. That it's traced through even the rebellion during the time of Nimrod. Traced through to Abraham, as we're in our study so far, and we know it eventually will lead to Christ and the payment of that sin for us. Father, let us go rejoicing in that, but also looking at the world around us and remembering that you are God, we are not, and that we need to follow you. In Jesus' name, amen.